Good afternoon, it's Mountain Edition. I'm Elizabeth Stewart Severy.
And I'm Wyatt Orm. Garfield County will give a psychiatric hospital in Grand Junction $50,000.
An expert in art therapy comes to the Valley.
Aspen and Snowmass set occupancy records last month.
Some in the Valley's Latino community prepare for the worst as immigration enforcement changes.
And two National Geographic contributors shared their experiences hiking the Grand Canyon with local students.
Those stories and more coming up on Mountain Edition.
Snowmobilers and backcountry skiers can no longer park along Woody Creek Road near Lenado, a Picken County District judge has ruled, and a controversial land exchange is on hold.
For decades, the county has maintained a parking area along the road for snowmobilers heading to Cobie Park and backcountry skiers going to Margie's Hut. Two Lenado homeowners brought a lawsuit against the county nearly 10 years ago, claiming that the parking resulted in trespassing and devalued their property. Retired Judge Daniel Petrie ruled in favor of the homeowners. A press release from Picken County encourages snowmobilers to shuttle from the intersection of Upper River Road and Woody Creek Road near the Woody Creek Tavern. 10th Mountain Hut users may park in a small lot near the trailhead. Also yesterday, the citizen group Colorado Wild and Public Lands won a request to delay the closing of a controversial land exchange. The Bureau of Land Management announced earlier this week that it would complete a pending exchange of about 1,500 acres in Picken and Eagle counties for about 670 acres of private land at the base of Mount Sopris near Carbondale. But Colorado Wild and Public Lands has an existing appeal with the Department of the Interior, claiming that the public land is undervalued. Supporters of the exchange say the deal would bring more public access for recreation. Hawk Greenway with Colorado Wild and Public Lands says the appraisal of the land is skewed, and the BLM is trading high-quality land on a remote area of Mount Sopris for less acreage that would allow more recreation.
Our contention has been that the access doesn't need to be vehicular access to BLM land, and in fact, some of our most favored and sought-after experiences here in Colorado are the remote and difficult to access places.
Thursday's ruling gives an additional 6 weeks for the Department of the Interior to review the exchange.
An expert on the relationship between the arts and medicine was in town this week to speak about how families can introduce art therapy into their own communities. Aspen Public Radio's Claire Woodcock has more.
For those living with a chronic illness or who have a friend or family member who struggles with one, Elizabeth Auer has an easy prescription to fill: art. Auer is the Assistant Director of Performing Arts for the University of Florida. She'll be in Aspen making the case for caregivers to incorporate music, dance, or the visual arts into a patient's everyday treatment plan.
If you have someone dealing with cancer, someone who has Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, and how you can utilize the arts in their everyday life just to make their life experience much more pleasant and give you a chance to connect.
Art as Medicine will take place at the Limelight at 6 p.m. tomorrow. Local musician Dan Sheridan will perform. Claire Woodcock, Edless Neeson, Arts and Culture Desk.
Occupancy records were again set last month in Aspen and Snowmass, but that streak is slowing down as the winter wears on. Allison Bechtesh reports.
Hotel bookings in Snowmass Village in January rose almost 10% from the same month last year, and the revenue those bookings produced rose 14%. Aspen also had its busiest January since record-keeping began in 2007. Aspen's average nightly rate was $562. Bill Tomsich, president of the Central Reservations Agency, Stay Aspen Snowmass, attributes the record-breaking occupancy rates to the back-to-back weekends of Holiday Spillover, the Martin Luther King Jr. Holiday, Gay Ski Week, and a valley-wide sellout during X Games. So far, February has been emptier than previous years. Tomsich says locals will feel the crowd again as flights increase leading up to the FIS World Cup Finals in March. Allison Bechtesh, Aspen Public Radio News.
West Springs Hospital is a psychiatric hospital in Grand Junction. On Monday, the Garfield County Board of Commissioners voted to give it $50,000.
West Springs is the only psychiatric hospital between Denver and Salt Lake City. It has 32 beds, and it wants 64. Mind Springs runs the hospital. They say they'll need just under $18 million for the expansion. Statewide, there are 24 psychiatric beds per 100,000 people. On the western slope, there are six. Six beds compared to 24, and the need is rising. In 2016, West Springs admitted 148 people from Garfield County, and this was a 41% increase from the year before. The Board of Commissioners received letters from the Sheriff, the Department of Human Services, Valley View Hospital, and others, all supporting Mindspring's request for money.
President Trump's battle with the media doesn't show any signs of letting up. But in Colorado, Republicans hope divisive rhetoric doesn't impede their ability to get their message out. They've come up with something very un-Trump, a model they say will improve their relationship with the media. Benta Berkland has this story.
The new Senate Majority Leader Chris Hulbert has started doing something old school, something the president is criticized for not doing enough of. Both he and the Senate president are holding weekly press briefings.
Again, I really appreciate your willingness. We hope that this is more of a traffic cop. You know, here's what's interesting, rather than us just being the ones quoted.
That's Chris Hulbert outlining GOP plans to hold its next briefing.
Our leadership perspective with President Grantham and I is that we really want to be more open and inclusive.
They will also host their first ever off-the-record happy hour with reporters. The goal, he says, is for members of the Senate to get to know the press in a more relaxed setting. Republicans in the House, who are in the minority, recently tried that idea with their own happy hour. Joel Maleka is their spokesman.
The national news a lot of times dominates news cycles. So when they read and they hear these examples of media bias, that, you know, it's very natural for them to want to feel that that extends to the legislature and the reporters they work with here. So I completely understand why they feel that way.
For some Republicans, this openness is new. Not all trust the media. Others have had bad personal experiences, like Representative Justin Everett from Littleton. He says some media outlets have reported inaccurate or misleading stories about him. He chalks it up to laziness, the 24-hour news cycle, and diminished resources.
I think that's what builds that mistrust amongst Republicans, is I think that they think there's a liberal media bias, and then when you kind of see it in little things like that, that sort of reinforces that.
Everett feels that most local reporters are ethical, and says he thinks better personal relationships lead to better stories. Freshman Representative Philip Covarrubias is a construction foreman from Brighton. He thinks the media asks too many gotcha questions.
On the Republican side, we're so worried about what's going to be said about us instead of being able to speak our truth about policy. The left has put us in fear of saying anything because the first thing that happens is if you oppose the left's policies, you're a racist, homophobe, xenophobe, every kind of istrophobe that there is.
Perhaps feeding the perceptions of bias are the feelings of Democrats. Many at the state capitol enjoy a good working relationship with the media. Democratic Representative Javon Melton from Aurora doesn't expect that to change and wonders if the GOP's problem is its leaders.
I think we get along with the media, we get along with each other across the aisle. I think Colorado's a little different than D.C. And truthfully, I don't know if the Republicans really have a problem with the media as much as Trump has a problem with the media.
National coverage can also sting media relationships. For instance, Republican Senator Jerry Sonnenberg from Sterling recently felt he was misquoted by the Washington Post. Colorado lawmakers also acknowledge that the state capitol can be a bubble. They admit that they forget between television, newspapers, radio, and the internet just how big the media's influence is. So that symbiotic relationship between the press and legislators is here to stay, whether lawmakers like it or not. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
Aspen City Councilman Bert Myron wants to know why the new police department building is slated to run on natural gas.
The $22.5 million new building for the Aspen Police Department will not be powered by the city's all-renewable energy grid, but rather run on natural gas boilers. City Facility Manager Jeff Pandarvis told council earlier this week that cost and undue burdens on neighbors are concerns. The building will need to be operational 24 hours a day, and Pandarvis says this makes electric power cost prohibitive. At Monday's council meeting, Myron made it clear that he isn't buying it.
Yes, except in the 70s, I think, when people used electric and it actually worked for some reason. I don't know why it worked 40, 50 years ago. Now we have to burn dinosaurs.
Myron is now pressing city manager Steve Barwick to review the decision for the new city-owned building to use fossil fuels.
A student of the Anderson Ranch Arts Center has won the 60th annual World Press Photo Award. Claire Woodcock reports.
Amber Bracken began studying with Anderson Ranch last summer. She spent the season being mentored by photojournalists Ed Cashy and James Estrin. That's when news of the Standing Rock protest over the Dakota Access Pipeline began to spread.
and it was enough of a motivation for Bracken to go to the protest with her camera and start shooting.
I've been following Indigenous issues for quite some time, and land rights and their fight to recover from colonization. So I was following the situation in Standing Rock from April, but it definitely hit a critical mass in the beginning of September that made me kind of realize all at once that this was a movement and I needed to be there.
The ranch's artistic director, Andrea Wallace, says Bracken's photo essay is exactly the kind of success the Advanced Mentor Studies Workshop hopes for in its students.
It gives them a supportive environment and a sense of community and that sustained mentorship that's really critical in working in a long-term documentary project.
Winners were chosen from roughly 5,000 photographers. Based in Alberta, Bracken will return to the ranch this summer. Next week, she's hoping to get back to Standing Rock. Claire Woodcock, Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Wyatt Orm. To stay up to date with news in the Roaring Fork Valley, follow us on social media. Like us on Facebook, find Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter, or follow us on Instagram. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station. The Gorsuch House development proposal brought scores of public comment to the Aspen City Council this week. Half are in favor of the new hotel and chairlift, the other half object to the size of the development. As both sides regroup before the continued hearing, Aspen Public Radio's Allison Bektesh catches us up.
There's a big game going on in town right now. The Gorsuch House proposal is almost 1,000 pages long and triggers 8 different land use review processes. It's messy and there are a lot of moving parts, but as the project dips into a 7th inning stretch, we're going to get caught up by talking baseball. At bat is Aspen businessman Jeff Gorsuch. He and his partners want to build a hotel and revitalize the access point on Ajax near the 40-year-old 1A chairlift. This requires a 3-step approval process. The game starts with getting the Planning and Zoning Commission to approve the project. That didn't happen. The 6-member citizen board voted unanimously recommending denial. The next inning is getting City Council to approve the project. In this case, staff does not support the development. 0-2 for Gorsuch House. But fans say there are merits to the development. Former Mayor Bill Sterling is among those who still have their rally caps on. He addressed council during public comment on Monday.
It will offer hot beds, great public gathering spaces, a new lift, more affordable housing. It'll be a sensational framework for future World Cup races, NORAM races, and local Aspen Ski and Boarding Club events. Those are the things that make us truly a ski town.
See, the Gorsuch House project isn't just a hotel. Design mock-ups show an entire plaza, similar to that at the base of Aspen Highlands. There's a restaurant and bar, condos, a public plaza, and a new high-speed quad. The land in question has been zoned conservation since 1975, an effort to keep Aspen's southwest side small and focused on recreation. So, yes, some bases would be stolen by skirting those parameters, but proponents say the replacement of Lift 1A is a huge public amenity that is surely worth trading for a couple of stories on a hotel. Councilmember Ann Mullins questioned if that really is a fair trade. Everybody seems to agree about revitalizing the mountain's west side, but
revitalizing is not burying the lift within the hotel complex. It's opening that whole thing up so that's publicly accessible and is supported by this lodge.
Council is not done speaking with the Gorsuch House applicants about their plan, but let's pretend they do knock it out of the park and get an approval. That Ski Co-owned land would need to be rezoned, which would be a whole new ballgame. Aspenites have been known to throw a curveball and challenge zoning changes through a citizen referendum. Allison Bektesh, Aspen Public Radio News.
The Aspen Santa Fe Ballet is in its 20th season. Saturday marks the world premiere of a new piece being performed at the Aspen District Theater. Claire Woodcock has the backstory.
Cherise Barton has always been fascinated by spectacle.
By theater, by large-scale productions, film, Broadway.
Barton's credits sparkle. Her choreography has seen both the grand stages of Broadway in Vegas as well as television screens in L.A., but her backdrop is ballet.
I felt more grounded in the studio than I did anywhere else. And I soon realized over the years that even though I had ventured into these exciting worlds, I needed to return to the studio. I needed it for not only my own sanity, but for my own creativity.
Barton is the new choreographer behind the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet's latest work, Eudaimonia, Greek for happiness. The ballet reflects on Barton's own lifelong search for inner peace. It revolves around the notion that the adrenaline rush brought on by feelings of intense euphoria is fleeting.
It was a big realization for me the day that I realized that that feeling that I would always have when I felt really great after a show or when I was playing with my kids, that happy feeling, I always wanted it to last. And it never did.
It's clear that Barton's vision is resonating with the company. Tom Mossbrooker, artistic director at the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet, is happy with the symbiotic relationship Barton and the company have developed. He anticipates that the audience will find the new piece refreshing.
We're still celebrating our 20th anniversary. We have incredible repertoire. We have incredible dancers in the company. I think we're really at a real high point right now.
Also on the ticket this weekend are two modern ballets the company premiered in 2016. Alejandro Cerruto's Little Mortal Jump and Erie Killian's Sleepless. But this weekend, Eudaimonia is the centerpiece of the program. That's because of Barton's fascination with character building.
One of the dancers in my piece, Pete, his role in this piece is he's happiness. He is that idea that I was always holding on to.
When you're in an office space and there's the one guy who's really happy, I think overall that's my guy.
That was Frederick Leo Walker, but everyone calls him Pete. He's been with the company for 2 years and sees how abstract ballets aren't always accessible to audiences. Whereas in Eudaimonia, Walker says that Barton's choreography always reflects on the character's emotions.
As we go throughout the process, I'm starting to learn maybe this happy guy does have a different side. Maybe he does feel something different or is affected by, you know, some of the dancers.
The new work unfolds like a short story, except the only words come from the music, another personal touch Barton has included. The steps in the ballet are clever and minimal, giving a quick nod to the modern ways that humans try to preserve feelings. But the story always comes back to this overarching theme of happiness. Barton explains why.
Happiness is simple, but the way in which we seek it is very complicated, and it's universal.
One way Barton seeks to achieve this is by collaborating with the dancers throughout the entire creative process.
Most choreographers want to choreograph and tailor to the dancer, and I think she's really committing to that. So there's a few steps that I've done since I was a kid, you know, with a lot of breakdancing that she's incorporating.
Walker found ballet as a teenager, but really his big introduction to dance came from learning to breakdance. To showcase his background, Barton added a backspin followed by a kickout to one of his sequences. Although Barton insists her dances are linear, she says that Eudaimonia will always remain up to audience interpretation.
Nobody needs to know exactly what every dancer's journey is or what every little thing means, every little movement. They can make up their own story as they watch it.
After Saturday's show, the company goes on tour, with performances scheduled in Beaver Creek and Denver next weekend. The company will return to the Aspen stage for an encore performance on April 1st. Claire Woodcock, Aspen Public Radio News.
This past week, immigration authorities arrested hundreds of undocumented people across the country. The Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, says this is nothing out of the ordinary. Still, fears are flaring up nationwide, and the Roaring Fork Valley is no different. Wyatt recently attended a meeting in Carbondale about ICE.
It's Sunday afternoon, and a basement classroom at Bridges High School is so packed, people hover around the doorways to listen in.
And, you know, there's lots of room. You don't all have to be in the back.
The crowd is thinnest at the front of the room, where Jennifer Smith is standing. She's an immigration attorney in Glenwood. The names of state senators, their numbers, hotlines, and websites are scrawled on the whiteboard behind her in green marker. The woman speaking has a little boy in her lap. If she's deported, she wants to know if her 18-year-old daughter could take legal responsibility of him. But the daughter is also undocumented.
You have to think through the fact that your 18-year-old daughter may not be able to stay in the country either, and you may want to choose somebody else.
Several feet from the woman, a middle-aged man sits with his back against the wall. He picks and picks at a scab on his thumb and jostles his knees back and forth. His name is Javier, He lives in Carbondale and works in construction.
Imagine you're somewhere and your family is somewhere else. That's the fear.
But it's more than just fear, he says.
Psychosis.
It's like a psychosis. ICE raids have been in the news a lot lately, and Javier came here this afternoon to quell his fears and get more information. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has long had a field office in Glenwood. But have they been more active recently, one woman asks.
I think that's a great question for the community. Since the election, have you seen ICE more often in the community? Mm-hmm. I have not yet. I haven't heard stories yet. But will that happen? I believe it will happen.
On January 25th, President Trump signed an executive order on immigration. It calls for more immigration officials and for local and state police to arrest people in the country illegally.
This was not a topic 2 years ago.
Joe DeSalvo is Pitkin County's sheriff. Under President Obama, there certainly were ICE raids and deportations, although the last one DeSalvo can remember was in the 90s. Trump's election has ushered in a new wave of paranoia, DeSalvo thinks. As county sheriff, he's been clear all along his job is not to enforce immigration law.
If ICE were to come into Pitkin County and were to scoop up 10 illegal aliens, I probably would not let those people be held in my jail.
If there's no warrant for these people's arrests, nothing signed by a judge, then DeSalvo doesn't want anything to do with it. He doesn't want to be a storehouse for ICE, he says, because he knows what that's like.
We would have a guy who's virtually accused of no crime sitting in jail just for being here illegally. And that clogged up our system, and it's not a place I want to go back to.
And even if he did want to go back to that place, he probably couldn't. Several courts have ruled that it's a violation of the Fourth Amendment to hold on an ICE detainer alone because it's not a judicially reviewed warrant. Back at the high school, one man speaks up, saying he's feeling scared, and then asks if the community can go and protest, like at city council meetings or something. Again, Jennifer Smith.
I think at this point it's a full court press. We do everything we can.
Smith organized the meeting. Just days before, there was a threat which closed schools throughout the valley. It was obvious some of the parents there in the basement of Bridges High School had thought it was immigration coming for their children. Smith says the gathering went well, but people need to know their rights. What they don't know can easily be used against them. If ICE comes knocking at someone's door, the people inside can refuse to open it. If they do open it, ICE has the authority to enter and question anyone they want. They can stop people on the street and ask questions like any police officer can.
And I think the thing that it creates is a sense of panic and fear in the community.
And this results in disengagement, which Smith says makes everyone less safe.
I mean, if they don't feel safe calling the police, that is not great for any of us.
You're listening to Mountain Edition. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. While you're browsing, make sure to sign up for ForkFed, our weekly digital newsletter. ForkFed arrives in your inbox every Friday afternoon, catching you up on the week's news in a fun way.
Two National Geographic journalists recently completed an 800-mile trek through the Grand Canyon on foot. They wanted to understand this most iconic of national parks and the development that threatens it from all directions. Elizabeth joined the duo last week as they shared lessons from the expedition with Aspen High School students.
For the past 14 months, Pete McBride and Kevin Fedarko have been hiking through the Grand Canyon's rugged terrain with few trails. They are now about to take off on a national speaking tour. But first, they stopped here in McBride's hometown and spent a day talking with high schoolers. Fedarko says young people need to be aware that decisions being made now will determine what lands they will be able to explore later in life.
I was born in 1965. The head gates to the Glen Canyon Dam were closed in 1963. Lake Powell had flooded Glen Canyon before I completed infancy. I was never even given the chance to see Glen Canyon. And so something that I think I and many other people regard as part of my birthright as an American citizen was taken away from me by people who made that decision in the 1950s and the 1960s. Similar questions and changes and decisions are being made right now in connection with the Grand Canyon.
The Grand Canyon is the second most popular national park, with millions of visitors every year. And as McBride and Fodarko discuss, it's also under pressure from several potential developments. More housing close to the park, a gondola deep in the canyon, uranium mining, helicopter tours. McBride says it's important for the public, and especially students, to understand how such activities would impact the canyon.
So Kevin and I left a track of footprints through Grand Canyon National Park. And if all these development proposals can go forth or continue, these kids in here will never, ever, ever be able to repeat the same line of footprints that we did through the same park. It'll be a different place.
And he says it's not just about this one national park. Public lands across America and the world are being taxed more than ever. Closer to home for these students, the U.S. Forest Service has rolled out plans to limit the number of people who can camp at the most popular spots after years of overuse, accumulating trash, and damage to fragile ecosystems.
The whole point of our project is to use an adventure to highlight a very iconic national park that is symbolic of wildlands across our entire country and beyond. And if we can't protect the Grand Canyon, what can we protect is the main question.
McBride and Fodarko address this question through photos, storytelling, and a film that McBride is producing. They showcase a serious desert adventure, complete with stunning vistas, long days hiking where there is no trail, and some run-ins with cacti. And they also examine the intangible, romantic lessons that come from long days exploring the wild land around the Grand Canyon. Here's Fodarko.
The most extraordinary, the most profound, the least understood, and the most vulnerable treasure the canyon contains is not visual, it is auditory. It is the deep and dense and crystalline level of silence that defines this space when you get far enough out into it that you cannot hear anything other than the sound of the blood running through the vessels inside of your own ears.
That silence, Fodarko says, reveals both the fragility of America's public lands and the bonds that develop among people in these wild places. And perhaps most critical in learning the value of public lands is spending time in them. Like these students, McBride grew up here and participated in the outdoor education programs offered in the Aspen area schools.
I think the wilderness area around here, the mountains, the rivers, the lakes, the canyons are the best classroom we have.
It's in that classroom that these students might start to ponder what Fodarko says is the key question in determining the future of America's public lands.
You spend enough time in a place like this, the land begins to ask you, how do you want to look at me? How do you want to regard me? What do you want to do with me?
Fodarko says he and McBride do not presume to answer that question, but it's on these sophomores' minds as they run to their next classes.
It was really, really cool and really interesting. I really enjoyed it.
What are you thinking about walking out?
Just what the land means to different types of people.
Exploring more.
So they, too, can find a trail through America's public lands while they remain wild.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. I'm Wyatt Orme.
And I'm Elizabeth Stewart Severy. To hear this show again or subscribe to our Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in tomorrow at 3:30 for Valley Roundup. News director Carolyn Zachariasen talks with a panel of local journalists about the week's news.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.